and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from Snake Oil on the Shopping List, How Pseudoscience Ends Up in Your Shopping Cart by Dr. Rebecca Vismeg Kamalander. It was first broadcast live on Thursday the 24th of April 2025. A video of this and many other recordings are available at sitp.online. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you'd like to support what we do, you can subscribe to our Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub online.
Thank you. You threatened to butcher my name and you absolutely did not do that, so I'm quite surprised. But yeah, let's get started, I think. And we can launch right in, I guess. As you can see on that lovely, beautiful slide there, it says Skeptics. We are a German Skeptics Club, so also within the orbit of the German Skeptics in the Pub organizations. So if you're ever curious, there's that little link on the bottom, skeptics.org. Feel free to come by and check it out. I hope we can make more connections internationally in the coming years and months. All right, let's get started. So as Brian said, already really aptly said, title is Snake Oil on the Shopping List. And the question is really how pseudoscience and woo end up in our shopping carts. Because I reckon if I speak to skeptics, I'm pretty sure that most of you don't really care about buying any nonsensical pseudoscientific stuff. But we tend to be tricked every now and then. And we wonder sometimes how that happens. Even if you are trying to be critical of what you put in your cart, you end up with nonsense. So today, I'm going to delve a little bit into how that might possibly happen. And there's a little bit of an overview as to how we're going to go about that trip. So to figure out how the woo ends up in our shopping carts, I'm going to talk about consumer culture first a little bit and kind of like try to understand the question as who buys what for what reason. So there's tons of W words in there, so you can kind of get that there's some multiple facets that we have to take a look at. We're going to talk a little bit about snake oil in the supermarket shelves, but also in pharmacies. And then also talk about how brand identities are featuring quite largely in that and what role they play. So how does branding, advertising, and design affect why we buy what we buy? And what stories does that tell? What does placement have to do with all of that? And then I'm also going to talk a little bit about the so-called halo effect. Before finishing off by just talking briefly about a concept that I've also talked about in my PhD thesis, which is consumer literacy. So the ability basically to understand the narratives that consumer goods are charged with. So let's just delve right in by talking about consumer culture and what that actually is or can be. I'm going to read the slides out to you, so for anybody who's got issues reading them, so you can get the content as well. So consumer culture, the way I see it, is basically a social and an economic practice in which the consumption of goods and services plays really a central role in people's lives and also in the emergence of social values, of identities and status symbols. So we're going to use them in many different ways. Consumer culture is also closely linked to the development of market economies and globalization. So without those two things, you can't really develop a full-fledged consumer culture in the sense that I'm talking about. And it impacts on how individuals and communities construct and express their needs, their desires, and their social relationships, right? For example, through gift giving and things like that. And that is most crucial here. Consumer culture goes beyond like a purely practical purchase of goods that's just based on what you need right now for a practical reason, and informs both the formation of individual identities and the structure of our modern societies, because many of our relationships are expressed through consumer culture. And to get a little bit into how consumer culture works, I'm going to do a little bit of an experiment with you guys. So you're going to be my guinea pigs tonight. Take a quick look at that slide that I've just popped up on the screen, right? So we've got a young woman there wearing colorful clothing. On the opposite side, with marked with a B, is a guy wearing a black slim fit suit, very sleek, very business. So when we see these people, I guess we all have kind of like ideas as to what they might and might not purchase. And this is what passing on to you now, so you can play along. I'm going to skip to the next slide, and there's a couple of products on that one, and I want you to kind of guess which of the person, A, the woman, or B, the guy, is the person buying that product. It's not going to be taking very, very long, so I'm just going to say the number that's right next to the product and kind of like briefly describe it for anybody who has got issues seeing it, and then you can pop in the chat whether it's a product that person A or person B would buy. All right, so let's get that started. So product one, we've got like this lovely Boss shower gel, silverish bottle with a black boss logo on. What do you think? Person A or person B? Pop it in the chat. Yeah, tons of B's already. All right. B for boss. Very good. Then let's pop on to the second one. Like JBL headphones, purplish color with some like orangey red highlights on them. Person A or person B? Ah, there we go for all the A's. Pink goes to pink, yeah. But that's a good reasoning, I guess. Then product number three, it's like a black Stanley cup. You know, these coffee mugs, silverish highlights, black base, A or B. This bee bag, a gift for A's, right? All right, tons of B's there. And then four, we've got like that lovely Oatly yogurt alternative, strawberry flavor, like pinkish, pale pinkish packaging. Who's buying that? Ah, bit of A, bit of B. Some mixed messages here. That's good. Okay, we've got an Oatly fan in there. Legit. Then number five, toothbrush, black electric toothbrush. With like that was one of these super intelligent guys that kind of like helps you do your oral hygiene if you haven't learned it as a kid. Tons of bees again. Alrighty. And then we're going to go to the same brand that we've had already for number six, which is like another Stanley Cup. But you know, the huge ones in orange with a straw. All right, the A's are popping up again. And the question mark B. Alrighty. Then, halfway through almost. There you go. Already done. There's a little backpack, like lavenderish color, pale lavenderish color by Fjällräven. A or B? A is coming up again. As a B? Alrighty. A probably, all right. Then, moving on to number eight. For number eight, our presenter has another pair of headphones. Black ones this time. I think Spang and Olufsen with like a little bit of a square design, very sleek. B is buying it for a season, I feel okay. Both, totally both already. Another both, good. Number nine, the polar opposite to the other normal toothbrush. It's just like a wooden toothbrush with like bluish bristles. Guess like some kind of ecological thing because it's made of wood, not of plastic. Both? Neither? It's a bit of insecurity there. Hopefully neither. Alrighty. And then the last three. Number 10, we've got like the Ginger Morning shower gel, green bottle, very kind of slightly whimsical design. Who's buying that? The A's cropping up, another B. Both already? Mostly A. Okay, good. And then the last two. Number 11 is like a GetPro protein yogurt, like sleek black packaging with a huge blueberry on and like a large lettering saying the protein contents, like 50 grams of protein within the cup of there. So tons of B's, a triple B. That's very good. Ah, the Viennese also is a B, that's good. Yeah, exactly, B protein, precisely that. And then for the last one, it's like another bag, like a black leather crossbody bag, I guess, like messenger briefcase. B definitely. B and an A. Yeah, all right. So if we look at the responses that the chat's come up with, right, we can see that there is quite a few people that say both for quite a few things and kind of like ask whether it's could go either way or kind of like criticizing that certain people shouldn't be buying any of those products. But you can see that there's quite a majority for each of the products, kind of like attributing them to the similar people. So we've got a lot of the colorful stuff being attributed to person A, a lot of the black and sleek design stuff being attributed to person B. That is something that's not super surprising because obviously we respond to visual cues, But we also respond to what the marketing and the packaging has said, right? There is the yogurt thing is a really good example, I think, because somebody in the chat said B definitely because of the protein. And that's absolutely a marketing strategy that's been aiming at selling those products to men as well, because the health conscious kind of like yogurty things have always been branded and designed in ways that speak more to women. And then there has been that trend of a brand that started in the US that's actually called Brogurt, which was specifically trying to aim at health conscious, muscled up guys that were trying to be a little bit more muscular and then need to eat their protein. So that's an easy way of marketing to those types of consumers. What's important then is also the narrative value of those things, right? So we kind of associate certain things with certain age groups, with certain genders, with certain kind of like design languages, which is why it's fairly clear who's attributing which product to what person. And that is something that's also deeply rooted in consumer culture, that there is a narrative value here that takes center stage. So this is a quote that I've like, it's an own translation from a German art historian, Wolfgang Ulrich, from his volume Haben Wollen, so Want to Have, if you translate that freely. And he says, only a society in which desires can be expressed and given consideration has a chance of establishing a consumer culture, and not just a necessity-driven barter system. However, this requires that goods be symbolically charged beyond their utility value and developed into things that flatter their owners, support their attitudes, or even transform them. So we already know here that products can say something about ourselves. We can communicate something about ourselves to others, but we can also reaffirm our own identities and the way we view ourselves, which is quite crucially the reason why I did that little experiment with you, because that's something that I've more or less stolen from Wolfgang Ulrich. He's been writing about a guy who owns a flat in Munich and is hardly ever there because he's out on business most of the time. It's a super sleek new flat with a very plain architectural style. And because he doesn't use the flat that often, he kind of like came up with the idea to give it up as a gallery space for artists to come into and use for exhibitions while he's gone. And he's had a performance artist there, a woman who's like super hippie-ish, really freakish in the way she dresses, crazy punky, colored hair, all these things that you would say are polar opposite to him. And while she was in that gallery space, she kind of like pretended to move in with him. So she's brought all her stuff there. And she's been one of those people, you know, that uses like pink glittery plastic glasses instead of the crystal that he's had in his cupboards, to use just one example. And part of that art project was that he came back for a couple of days. They've both been given shopping lists with the exact identical items on. So really everyday stuff, like the stuff that we've seen there, right? Toothbrushes, yogurts, shower gels, toothpaste, things like that. And then when they came back, they mixed everything up. And the gallery guests, the viewers, were supposed to kind of like distribute out who bought what. And they've had like an almost 100% success rate with figuring out who had picked which product. And we can see here already that certain things are marketed to certain people, and that does not only apply to more expensive things like fashion or even like super aspirational consumer goods like cars, for example. It already applies to stuff like toothbrushes and yogurt and shower gels, so everyday items that we buy on a regular. So there is something there that helps us kind of like pick them out, be it the color scheme, be it the fonts, be it what we actually associate with that. So they become identity goods. And identity goods, as Heinz Trüg describes it, is a specific type of good, right? So the term identity goods refers to by no means only the so-called good things from the manufactum catalog. Mass-produced industrial goods can function as identity markers just as easily. I'm not quite sure. I think manufactum is not really as much of a thing in the UK as it is in Germany. But manufactum is like a brand that kind of like prides itself on selling very specific artisan handcrafted high quality products. Most of that is overpriced nonsense. So they've got fire extinguishers and chrome optics for €500 or stuff like that. But they are very specifically kind of like pointing out that that these the way these products are sold and the way these products are branded communicate something about the person to the person that's buying them, right? I'm buying something that's better than what the rest of us has. And it's not that the price and the quality and the upmarket status says much about whether that can be an identity good. We can see already that this also works to quite a fair extent with everyday items. But why is it really that this works? So we can look into the status that consumer goods have achieved within our societies, right? And Wolfgang Ulrich says again, modern design and marketing, supported by numerous scientific disciplines, have led to the same abilities being ascribed to ordinary objects as have been attributed to works of art for the past 200 years. They unlock memories, they fictionalize our everyday environment, they transform identities, and they offer perspectives for the future. Of course, this does not at all take into account the tons of really legitimate criticism that you can leverage against capitalist systems. If you ever want to look into that a bit more, I really, really strongly suggest you read Naomi Klein's No Label, which is a really great book on that kind of front. But what we're looking at here is just like how the design and the way products are marketed and put out there can actually impact the way we read them. So consumer goods have really become central to our everyday lives. We are buying stuff constantly on a regular basis, day in, day out. So they basically become omnipresent. And most of us don't really think about the minor purchases that we do, but we respond to cues that we see on the supermarket shelves all the time. So they tell us things. And the question then is, how do they tell us things? Well, they do so because they basically become charged with meaning. What you see on the slide here is like a little bit of a graph that is kind of like symbolizing the meaning transfer model that's been developed by Grant McCracken, who's like a cultural scientist, and he does a lot of research into how the fashion system and consumer culture has actually impacted the way consumer goods function in our society. So there is like what he calls the culturally constituted world, which is the world on the outside that we are all moving within. And that kind of is the way that is the surroundings that we have interchanges in, that we talk in, that we relate to other people. And that's basically the background for that specific model. And from that cultural sphere, meanings that we ascribe, stories that we tell, are actually transferred onto consumer goods. And that functions A, to the fashion system and the advertising system. Advertising, obviously, is fairly easy to understand. We see advertising all the time, be it posters, be it, ads on our Twitch streams if we haven't signed up for an account. And they tell us stories about the products. Whether we totally take that on or not is a different question, but we kind of like subconsciously obviously listen to those messages. The fashion system also is then like what dictates what trends are, do we follow them or not, within what subculture has what specific aesthetic codes, do we adapt to them, and those types of things. And they attribute meanings to the consumer goods, right? As an example that's just popped up in a different stream that I tend to watch on Twitch in the mornings, the IKEA Blåhais, I don't know if you know that, these little sharks, that have become an internet sensation, right? So there has been a contribution by the fashion system that has charged those little plushies with a meaning. They've become icons for trans rights. They've become super popular within specific subcultures. So whenever you see somebody carrying around that plushie, you can kind of make an educated guess about what that person's political stance is, for example. So that's stuff that happens via the fashion system. Advertising system, I think I don't really have to dig into anymore. And then from the consumer goods that we can find in our shelves, like for example, our little shark at IKEA, we have then ways of transferring that meaning to the individual consumer. And what Kraken kind of like splits that up into is, first of all, possession rituals, exchange rituals on the second bit, then grooming rituals and divestment rituals. So it's basically the way we relate to the consumer goods and the consumer goods relates to us. possession rituals are, for example, what you can see on the back behind me on my wall. I've collected all types of things from places that I've been to, and I put them up on my wall because I want to keep them and I want to showcase them to me and to my guests and to everybody who's kind of like watching me in a stream every 500 years, to kind of like communicate to them what's important to me. So I keep them, I groom them, I look after them. Exchange rituals are stuff like gifts, for example, right? When we did that little experiment earlier, there were quite a few people that were actually saying, oh yeah, that's a product that B would buy for A, or A would buy for B, or B for their nephew, or stuff like that. So we can kind of picture there already that by gestures of affection that are often linked to consumer culture, we say something about how we relate to others. So we go in a hat and kind of like giving somebody that we, for example, know is really bookish, and we're buying them a nice book, we can tell them that we understand who they are, and we're saying that by the way of a consumer product. Grooming rituals, really, really lovely example for that one, I think, is just gearheads and their cars. So they have something that they have to look after, but they kind of like build a relationship with a material object, with a consumer good, because obviously cars are also a consumer good, although it's a really expensive one. Or, I don't know, gamers who collect nostalgia value, old game consoles and stuff like that. So they need some looking after, they need some maintenance. So there are grooming rituals there where actually the person's looking after the consumer good. But that's also working the other way around. So with cosmetics, for example, where products are actually used in grooming rituals where we groom ourselves, where we kind of like make ourselves up, or we take care for ourselves, and what we actually put on our bodies or in our bodies actually kind of also helps say something about ourselves. Then divestment rituals, this is obviously then the question as to how we get rid of things. Do we just kick them out? Do we pass them on to somebody else? Are we sustainable about these types of things? That also kind of like says something about our relationship to our surroundings and also to the products that we purchase. That's a really, really dense, really super, super condensed version of that model. I could talk about that for 5 more hours, but that's obviously way beyond of what we're capable of doing here. And I've got tons more examples about for how consumer goods can actually work and how the woo gets into our shopping carts. So I'm going to move on from here and talk a little bit about what that can mean then. So skipping to the next slide. We have to ask ourselves questions, right? So why then, if we know all of that, what we've just talked about, does snake oil sell so well? And what role does consumer culture, as I've just outlined it, play in its success? And I guess we have to look at two different factors here when we try to understand these purchasing decisions. On the first really important point, there are tons of individual factors, right? And especially when we look at people who sell not evidence-based, like in fat quotation marks, alternative medicine or some woo type of like healing conjunctions. That's obviously often aimed at people who are in distress and who are suffering, who have, for example, gone through loss or were suffering from pain, who are easily targeted and convinced to kind of like spend their last dime on something that allegedly might help them or that they can actually build some hope off of. Then we have a fairly common thing as well, was just ignorance of the customer, not necessarily in the way that people are just not educated enough, but people need to be aware of their surroundings. They need to be aware of tons of surrounding factors to actually make a really good informed decision. But that can also apply to the seller as well. So when you go through any occultist esoteric fair where people sell you nonsense, you'll fairly quickly figure out that there's quite a few people there who actually strongly, fully believe in what they're selling, and who are themselves not really fully informed about how or whether something that they sell can actually work. And then, of course, there's the question of like the charisma or the status of the seller. So is somebody who's really a trusted authority selling us something, is that a really charismatic person, which is obviously something that factors in quite a bit with influencer marketing, for example, right? We build a parasocial relationship with somebody, we trust them. When they advertise a product or kind of like suggest we buy one, we actually kind of more likely to fall for that or kind of more likely to purchase it. Doesn't necessarily always have to be a scam, but that's obviously built on the charisma and the personality of the person selling us whatever they're selling. What we're looking at, though, is more the second kind of like group of reasons. So it's factors I'd say are rooted in consumer culture that are systemic. So branding, visuals, and product design, which kind of like lead us to being appealed and being drawn to a product, advertising and promises, but then also product placement and what we're going to get to later, the so-called halo effect. So brand identity is really factor large in all of that. And what's quite crucial to understand here is that branding and brand identities are really multifaceted. This is exactly why when I did this experiment earlier, we didn't get straight A's or straight B's from everybody. Everybody has different associations. Some think more critically of consumer culture more broadly. Some think more critically of certain brands, of certain styles. So you'll never end up with everybody saying the exact same thing. And this is also hinting at the fact that brand and brand identities are not wholly controlled by the person who actually constructs them, so the producer, the company. As Martin Neumeyer has basically said in his book, The Brand Gap, a brand is not what you, as the person producing it, say it is. It's what they say it is. So the consumer, the recipients here really play a crucial role. And that little graphic on the right, so there's like a picture of a bust of Plato with like a thinking bubble with a stick horse in it. That refers to something that he said about the essence of certain objects. There is an essence of horseness, if you like. So if I say, think of a horse, you'll all have a picture of like a four-legged creature with a flying mane, probably quite muscular and quite strong in your head. But if I had each and every single one of you described very precisely what type of horse you were imagining, we'd probably have some black ones, some brown ones, some more rustic breeds, some a little bit more like, I don't know, racehorse-like features, some Clydesdales, God knows what. So you'll have very different individual ideas of what that is, although they all share a common essence of what we are talking about, right? So the way you perceive things always differs a little bit, even though we are talking about the exact same word and the exact same thing. So why then can we, what then can a brand do to kind of like try and influence as best they can what they, so the consumers on the opposite side of that transaction, actually feel and associate with the brand? So brand identities are something that's been subject to constructions and debates and scholarship, but as well as obviously nonsensical coachings for people who do marketing in tons of ways. And there's plenty of different models that you can refer to when you try to explain how brand identity is actually built up. I've chosen a fairly common one. I'm not entirely convinced that this is really the right or the perfect model to explain everything, but it gives everybody a good insight into how you can imagine what factors into branding. So we have these five pillars here. It's a five-pillar system. The first pillar for somebody who's trying to build a brand and is going about it strategically would be the purpose. So why does the brand exist? Why does the market need what you're trying to sell? The second pillar is personality. So what are you trying to look like? Like, what is your style? What is your tone? What is your design, right? Are you, going back to the example from earlier, a bit more whimsical and trying to talk to a younger consumer group? Are you super serious and scientific, for example? Or are you a little bit more artsy? So those types of things are something that you have to make a decision on, and that will impact the way you design and advertise your product. Then the third pillar, which is the central pillar here, is perception, right? So how do consumers perceive the brand? What message does actually arrive with them and what do they mirror back? The fourth one is positioning, which is basically the question as to where you sit within the market. What do other people who sell similar items to what you sell actually have in the market already? And what makes your brand special? What makes your brand stand out from that competition? And then fifth and finally, it's promotion. And I fixed the typo, Gerald. So that's basically advertising, which creates the first impressions, often even before a customer has ever had a proper encounter with the real product. And what we're focusing here mainly on today is perception, but we're also going to look into all the pillars from second to fourth, to fifth, so personality, perception, positioning, and promotion. Yeah, Coke adds life, exactly. Coca-Cola is a really good example for brand building. But we're going to look at an example for advertising for something a little bit more out there right now. And for some of the German people in the chat might actually know it. This is the well-known, really brilliant Edelsteintage fair. So it's basically a fair that's touring around Germany, which is focused on gemstones. And as you can see with that very lovely and very attractive, I hope the ironies can come through, advertising poster here, it's an absolute mess. It's super difficult to tell what this is all about, right? It's got, oh yeah, it's all pretty crystals. Precisely, there's pretty crystals. And there's a pretty young, smiling, happy blonde woman who holds up a slab of stone as if she were pretending to be some kind of crystal off-brand version of the Phantom of the Opera. I'm not quite sure what this is about. Yes, what is this about to tell us? And absolutely, this is a graphic design, is my passion style poster, that much for sure. So you can see really it's difficult to tell who are they trying to attract. Is that for jewelers? Is that for collectors? Is that for, I don't know, people who believe in crystal magic and just want to buy something for their magic ritual? Not quite sure, right? So it's a little bit for everything and it's an absolute mess. But there's a completely different way of selling the exact same product, namely this one here. That's an advert for the Gemworld Munich, which looks entirely different, right? So we've got a really clean, really simple design. We see on the first glance, this looks like something for jewelers, right? So it's focused on jewelry, it's for an industry kind of like audience. So it's fairly unlikely, I'd argue, that you'll encounter an awful lot of occultists trying to sell their healing stones there. Yeah, absolutely. It's nobody's surprise in Germany at all. And as I said earlier, that specific type of organizers touring around Germany, and we've visited it once in Cologne, I think last year at some point, with a part of our like skeptics club. And you can tell already that like half the people who actually go in there are not jewelers, and they are not geologists that are, I don't know, trying to find some rare fossil there. It's mainly healers. It's people who actually believe in some kind of witchcraft or magic or something like that. There's kind of people selling you angel stones and alien stones and all kinds of nonsense and woo there. But the graphic design is my passion poster already communicates to us that we are to expect that, right? So if you are kind of a little bit aware of how that design language actually sells nothing and everything at the same time, you're maybe a little bit more cautious than if you were actually going to the Gemworld in Munich, where you'd be probably way more surprised if you had somebody kind of like trying to sell you some crystal that's been blessed by an angel from outer space or nonsense like that. But those types of things here that are actually quite funny when we talk about just collectibles and stones and stuff like that can also translate into more serious, more critical areas. Yeah, kidney stones from angels, that's it, I like that. Which is medicine. So I reckon quite a few of the people of you who are in the UK might know Ainsworth. So they are like the first name in homeopathy, as they call themselves there. And it's just a screenshot from their website that I've taken in the last couple of days. And you can see already, I think, except for the fact that it says homeopathy in the header, it doesn't really scream homeopathy from the get-go and from the layout and the design. So it actually, you know, we have that nature imagery, we have that calm moment of the flowers in the sunset or the sunrise sitting there, which I think looks at the first glance as if you were just selling natural remedies, which are quite clearly distinct from what homeopathy is, because natural remedies can actually work because they can have types of ingredients and things that are actually affecting your system and can have a contribution to your healing. Not the same as like factory and produced things that are more better regulated, but obviously there are things that can actually function. And as I said earlier, in terms of testimonials and the beautiful impact of charisma and status, as you can see on the top left, they've actually been endorsed by the royals. I'm not gonna kind of like go off on a rant about how King Charles is actually reviving and has been lobbying for homeopathy in the NHS for forever now and what huge problematic impacts that can have. Well, he's not really charismatic, but yeah. But that's it. So there's a design language here that kind of like points at natural remedies, and it's endorsed by the royals, so it looks a little bit more serious than we should actually take it. But the Germans, once more, are actually quite good at taking that design thing a bit further. I'm not quite sure whether you know it. I think some of their products are actually marketed in the UK. So this is the screenshot from their UK website. It's a company called Heel. They, as you can see, claim to be a brand that produces healthcare designed by nature, which is why we have that lovely lady here looking at that vial with her protective glasses and her white lab coat and the white surrounding that all screams laboratory. It all screams science. And unfortunately, Gerald from Cologne might remember, I've had to swap that picture out. The last picture was also a stock photo, but that was way more hilarious because same model even, but she was wearing the glasses and looking through a microscope with her glasses on, which is obviously very necessary because stuff jumps in your eyes from the microscope all the time. So we can tell it was a bit of a cell phone there because it kind of like showcased in the stock photo that they picked that they actually don't really have that much of a clue about science. And they really don't, because although they look super scientific in the way they market themselves, modern, bright and clean, it's actually a nonsensical woo brand. So they the products that they sell are based on the idea of homeotoxicology, which is not quite homeopathy, but has similar basics. It's an idea that your body produces toxins, and when you actually have symptoms of an illness, it's not actually the illness, it's just your body trying to detox. And the remedies that they sell are also like super diluted, very similar to what homeopathy does. And they have a really infamous history if you look into them a little bit more. First of all, they've paid for the professorship of a nonsensical pseudoscientist at the Europe University Via Adrina in Frankfurt-Oder. And they've also gone after somebody whose name I've just seen jump by in the chat, namely Edzard Ernst. So there's a guy in Germany, he calls himself a journalist. He's actually an activist that kind of like goes after people who attack and debunk pseudoscience. And they've paid for him to run numerous websites. And Edzard Ernst has been one of the people that have come into his crosshairs as well. So that company is really very much interested in keeping their brand protected and their pseudoscientific nonsense alive. And they also express that self-identification as like proper medicine through their product designs. So this is Neurexan, which is one of the medicines in quotation marks that they sell, which is allegedly trying to help you sleep. As they claim, it's effectively and naturally helps you regain your inner balance by lowering your stress level. If you could tell me how that works, I'm happy to do that. I'll take that every day. And decreasing nervous restlessness and related sleep disorders. Break your vicious cycle by going calmly through the day, feeling relaxed, and therefore sleeping better at night. So they claim that has like some kind of systemic effect where you can actually be more calm and then sleep better. It's nonsense. There's like really no real evidence that this does anything really helpful except for maybe having a placebo effect. But as you can see in the product design, if I put that on a shelf at Boots between all kinds of other medicines, you wouldn't pick it out. If you don't know the story of the company, you wouldn't understand that this is not actual medicine. And there's another example I'm going to show you from a brand in Germany, Klosterfrau, which is even worse in my humble opinion. So the screenshot that I've put on the slide here are from two different products from the exact same brand. They have their own website. So the left one is Bronchicum, the right one is Monapax. They are both cough medicine. And as you can see, when you look at the packaging that's shown in those product pictures, they almost look identical, right? It's white boxes with the brand name, with the product name written on it. And then there's this stylized picture of a flower. So that's basically supposed to indicate which plant is mainly used to produce it on the top right. And they look almost the same. One is green, the other one's red. Hard to tell them apart. And I almost fell for Monapax, because the thing is, Monapax is bullshit. while a bronchicum is actually a functioning and fairly well-working cough medicine. And Monapax has been taken over by that brand a couple of years ago. So when I saw it first, I thought, well, I might as well buy that one. It looks exactly the same. It's from a brand I trust. I've had good experiences with bronchicum, so I can buy the other one as well. So that's actually, in my humble opinion, quite a problematic choice to make, that you sell two different products where actually one has evidence backing it up and the other one hasn't, with the exact same design, except for a change in the color scheme. So you can tell here already that there is also some kind of halo effect, which is the one that I'm gonna delve into a little bit later. So we have one product that projects a positive image on another. But the natural in the natural remedies is also super front and center with all that stuff. This screenshot is from the website of Neil's Yard. So I think a lot of people might know that, especially in the UK. They sell tons of like healthcare stuff and a ton of body care stuff and cosmetics, like lotions, tinctures, and that stuff. But they also sell, I've learned in the Promo German podcast now that they're pronounced Bach flower remedies, which anybody who's kind of like interested in pseudoscience and medicine knows are also nonsense. But they have very distinct product design lines, as you can see. So in the second photo in that little lineup here, we see a little brown bottle. That's the Bach flower remedy. The other one is just like a beauty product that they sell in the blue bottle. And you can see how this all kind of like blends in with that super nice neutral color palette. You have these lovely modern style architecture furniture on the photo on the right. So that's kind of like the customer that they envisage, right? If you live in a place like this, you can buy something nice like that. You have the organic chef on the left, kind of like telling you a little bit about the gut skin axis and how you can look after your skin by eating the right foods. So it's all that very like natural, organic type of health products that they're trying to sell. But the design doesn't really give it away straight away. But if you look into it, you can already stumble over a couple of like really weird choices. And Neil's Yard is super proud of these blue glass bottles, which I think are quite nice looking, and they sell them as well and market them as well because they look so nice. But they claim that they use them because they protect the products from being damaged by light, which technically, yeah, works a little bit. But any physicists in the chat, correct me if I'm wrong. But as far as I'm aware, brown glass bottles filter out way more different wavelengths. So technically speaking, you should stick to brown bottles if you want to protect your product from light. I think the actual reason why they picked the blue bottle is A, because it's a USP, so a unique selling point. It stands out on the shelves. It looks quite nice. And it also kind of like reminds people of other more high-class upmarket brands, in especially cosmetics that use blue bottles, like L'Occitane, for example. So it kind of like speaks a little bit more to what they're actually trying to stand out rather than actually protecting the products, I think, my interpretation. But fonts also matter. So the way you actually put your label on, what you can see here is the Waldorf computer front, which is a super classic thing that's everybody in Germany has seen, and anybody who's ever held a Veleda product in their hands has also seen. So they're quite popular in the UK as well. I'm not going to go too deep into that because that, again, is something that somebody else can take a five-hour talk about. The whole Waldorf thing is a product of anthroposophy. And here we go again. I've already mentioned in the pre-call earlier, I'm going to make some self-depreciating Austrian jokes. This is also something horrific that Austrians are to blame for. Rudolf Steiner specifically, who has kind of like come up with the idea of anthroposophy, and they have impacts on all kinds of things, on education, especially for children, on agriculture, on body care, on all types of nonsense. And he's also had really specific ideas of how design is supposed to function. And this Waldorf computer font, that is the standard font that they often use, is a product as a result of his design ideas. And you can see that in tons of Waldorf and anthroposophy related products, as you can see, like on the right, if you compare the Veleda logo to that font, the Biodynamic Agricultural College logo, all these anthroposophic brands pick up that font. But while I was preparing this talk and kind of like updating my slides from the Cologne talk that I did on a similar topic, I saw that it finally happened. Veleda did their long-announced rebrand, which is also kind of funny in terms of messaging here. So they've left the anthroposophic brand font behind a little bit. If you look closely, you know the form of the D is still quite similar. So it keeps elements of that, but it's way less striking and way less obvious. And they've replaced that little, I think it's supposed to be like an Aesculap snake in the logo, with the slogan Natural Science, which anybody who has any idea about what Steiner thinks and what anthroposophy is quite clearly knows is absolute nonsense, because that's got nothing to do with science. So it's just an esoteric, nonsensical idea that they've had. Steiner is thought of himself as a clairvoyant, and all the knowledge that he's producing kind of like something that he picked up from the ether. So it's not like there's a really, really solid understanding about anything that's scientific or evidence-based in those product lines. But as you can see, the font is trying to kind of like make that move and sell it more as a scientific product, and so do the product photos. And there's a shift within the anthroposophic sphere in terms of design quite a bit. So an idea here is that they've also redone the font that they did for the very own anthroposophic magazine that they produce. I'm going to skip a bit of that because otherwise we're going to be here at 10 p.m. still. But the aim of that font that's on the slide here, philia, is supposed to express anthroposophic ideas. It's an adaptive font, so the form of each given letter adapts to the letter that was there before. So they kind of like connect and interlink and are trying to kind of like express Rudolf Steiner's philosophies in font form. Something that obviously hasn't been as easily possible before we had computers that could actually algorithmically decide which letter is supposed to follow which one. But as you can see with these examples here with the NA and the AN, they shift and tilt a little bit in different angles so they can actually kind of like hug against each other and kind of like express that human connection that anthroposophists kind of like apparently think there is, but they're actually racist. So there you go. Not all of them, but the idea is very racist. But there's also fun things in product design. Yeah, sorry, Amy. There's also fun things in product design that we can talk about, which are these little things here. I don't know. I've never seen them in the UK. Maybe somebody has. Where you put these like numbers or kind of like cross out the barcodes on products. And the idea behind that is that they, if you don't cross them out or don't disturb them, they apparently function like antennas and they collect negative energies that are then transferred onto the product. So if you eat anything that's been in a box with an undisturbed barcode, you're probably either demonically possessed or poisoned by some kind of bad energy. So there's tons of brands, especially from that Waldorf spectrum, that have actually produced barcodes like this one with the that's crossed out, and then they also like use organic lines, so it's often innate, with like the infinity symbol that they put through there, because that's apparently breaking the energies up or something. But if you are ever in Germany and you are very worried about a product that doesn't have a disturbed barcode, you can buy that pen on the right for I think like 15 euros or something, and then you can cross it out yourself, which it apparently removes the energy. So you can't use a normal Sharpie or some kind of other pen. It has to be that very specific disturbing pen. So there you go. There's market gaps for every kind of nonsense. And this is also something that's kind of like inspired a couple of people to be very suspicious of products like these, that have like these shaped barcodes and stuff like that. So some of you might recognize the top left one is from Yogi Tea. That might be considered esoteric or problematic for other reasons, but it's not the barcodes. So those types of designs aren't at all about trying to disturb them and get negative energies out. They're just whimsical ways of playing with brand design, right? The bottom left one is from an Austrian beer brand, Stiegel. So that basically means a staircase. So they have that shape of the staircase, which is in their logo as well. It's just trying to spice up the design a little bit and make them look a little bit more whimsical and less boring. But where do we find those products? Well, in the supermarkets, in all kinds of different aisles, and all kinds of different placements. And placement is also something that's really important. So earlier I spoke about the medicines, right? So you'd be much more likely to actually go to a pharmacy. This is an example from Germany, but it doesn't look that crazy different from Boots, although the pharmaceutical system and the way medicine is sold is different legally as well in Germany than it is in the UK. But this is the environment you buy medicine from, right? You wouldn't go to a shop that has the graphic design is my passion style that we had on the poster earlier. So the surroundings within which a product is placed are actually saying an awful lot about whether or not you're likely to buy it. If I find an homeopathic remedy amidst like really evidence-based products, like is the case here, I'd be much more likely, even as a skeptical person, to buy it, especially if a pharmacist, for example, doesn't inform me about the fact that a product like the Hale products that I showed earlier that look like actual normal medicine are homeopathic or based on homotoxicity principles and nonsense like that. So you're way more easily fooled into buying products that are sold in that environment by somebody who's actually looking competent, and then you have to kind of like try to get the information yourself, which is way, way more difficult in an environment like that, where you're not as much on guard as you would be at an, I don't know, esoterical fair. And that's also something that kind of like trips a lot of people up who are trying to make ethical choices when they buy products. And that's particularly true for agricultural products, I don't know, meats, vegetables, you name it. What you can see here are screenshots from websites from the UK, from the UK Organic Board. So there's a couple of logos for organic food producers that they actually claim are really good. And the top left one, the orange one, is Demeter. And Demeter, for many, many reasons, is quite literally bullshit. And why that's literal, I'm going to talk about in a second. But they are kind of like mingled in with other just normal standard organic brands. And that's true to some extent. So they do fulfill they do fulfill all the regulations that they have to fulfill to get organic seals of approval from the EU, for example. But they do more than that. And that is the problem with Demeter. They have esoteric lunar calendars as to when they are supposed to plant and harvest stuff. They treat their animals with homeopathic remedies. And they also very much are full of literal shit. So they do this thing that as Germans we call the Kackhörnchen, so the shit horns, where they stuff cow horns with cow manure and bury them in the full moon. And then they have to stay in the ground for, I don't know, a couple of months. And then you have to dig them up in some different moon phase. And then they're ground down and put into an awful lot of water. So it's basically homeopathic doses of actual product in there in the end. And they use that then for fertilizing, which make absolutely zero sense because there's nothing in there anymore. And it's also people who are Demeter certified to actually have cows. They have to have breeds with horns, even though there's good reasons for breeds to not have horns, for injuries and all kinds of stuff, because they believe they are antennas that also can kind of like collect moon energy that then sticks within the animal. It's absolute nonsense. But if you want to learn more about that and get rid of all your money, you can take a course. So within the UK, if you have £95 lying around, you can take 47 lessons with 1.5 hours of video content about all that nonsense. So they do an intro into these biodynamic preparations. So you can basically do your own cow manure nonsense products there. Maybe somebody can do that as a research project. They want to be really masochistic. And this is the halo effect that I spoke about earlier, right? So the halo effect, if you take the definition from the Encyclopedia Britannica, it's just an error in reasoning in which an impression formed from a single trait or characteristic is allowed to influence multiple judgments or rating of unrelated factors. So that's technically in a term that's taken from psychology. So if you find somebody attractive, for example, you're way more likely to think that they are intelligent and competent than you do if you don't find them attractive. Those types of reasoning errors are actually where that originates from, but they also are very dominant in branding and marketing. So the branding mag basically says Think of the halo effect as a golden glow that spreads a good impression from one point to all the others. In marketing, when people like one thing about a brand, they tend to view the whole brand more positively. Good example for that, for example, is Red Bull. Red Bull has all kinds of huge systemic issues, from exploitation to the footprint, to the guy who owned the brand and who's died a couple of years ago, being super active and spreading COVID misinformation. So there's tons of not to like, but they are very conscious in, for example, funding sports across the globe, because there's a ton of people who are actually associate the funding for the sport that they like with that brand. So they're way more likely to buy a Red Bull product. Or if you, for example, ever bought, gives you wings, exactly. Yeah, so if you ever buy, for example, I don't know, a product from M&S, from an M&S own brand, you have an M&S sandwich and you really, really fancy that, it was really good, you're way more likely to buy other products from that same product range and go back and, like, I don't know, get your 10 kilos of Colin the Caterpillar gummy bears because you've liked that sandwich so much. So if you have one product within a brand lineup, that's also something that can make you more susceptible to buying another brand, which is the example that I made earlier with the cough syrups, right? I've had the good experience with one, I'm going to buy the other, although it's complete nonsense. And those are the pitfalls then that we really have to look out for. And this is where consumer literacy comes in. So that's something that I've used in my PhD thesis, where I've been basically focusing on literary analysis. But the point here is consumer literacy is defined as the ability of consumers to read the various facets of products and brands and make informed decisions accordingly. So this is obviously something that people will achieve to different levels, like actual literacy, right? You can't read every language, you can't understand every context. As you can see already, I've had a couple of German examples in because I've been trying to kind of retain some of the messages that I wanted to do. And I'm not as good as at navigating the UK market as I am at navigating the German and the Austrian market. So there are things that don't quite translate exactly the same way. So I'm much more comfortable navigating the markets of certain spaces than I am navigating the markets of others. And that's kind of like impacting my level of consumer skill, of consumer literacy skill. So generally, if you try to make informed decisions and are aware of your consumer literacy skills or try to improve them, there are a few questions that you can ask yourself when you go out shopping. So first of all, what does the design and the form and the design language tell me? What is it trying to convey? Is it trying to look scientific when it's not? Is it something that looks immediately esoteric so that I can basically avoid it from the get-go? Be aware of those types of hints and cues. Then also how the environment might actually influence you. So am I way more likely to pick up a drug from Boots, or am I trying to pick it up from, I don't know, a stall in Camden Locks? I've got no idea what a good example that would be. Do I know enough about the manufacturer? Like somebody in the chat just was surprised by the Red Bull history. Obviously, you can't research every product, but try to be aware of those types of things. And then always think about who sells the product and where do they sell it? How does that impact my decision-making? All right, and I guess with that, I can wrap up. I've got a couple of sources in the slides. If anybody wants to have them, holler at me. I can give them to you. So yeah, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for listening. And thanks for playing along with my stupid little game earlier.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, and please join me in applause in the text chat. Welcome back our speaker, Dr. Rebecca Wiesmeck-Carolander. Rebecca, welcome back. Let's dive into the questions, and thank you, everybody, for the excellent input. We're going to start ourselves off with Andrew K, not to be confused with Andrew WK, the party animal. So it says, excellent talk. Good work, Andrew K, getting straight in with the compliments. Great way of getting you upvoted to the top. So his question, more regulation or better education? How to beat the snake oil pushers? On regulation, are there any simple changes that could be particularly useful?
Difficult one. I think education definitely matters an awful lot, because if you understand the consumer culture that you're trying to navigate, chances are that you're not as easily tricked. You obviously can't avoid that fully. But there are some things that I think you could do in terms of regulation where you just are a bit more serious about, for example, going after people who do false advertising. In Germany, I don't know how that is in the UK, but in Germany, for example, we have regulations that prevent people from making certain health claims.
We do have similar, but I mean, the Advertising Standards Authority are, you know, tenacious but kind of toothless. So
yeah, that's the thing, right? It's a slap on the wrist, but it doesn't really harm the bottom line enough, I think, for most companies to actually change their ways if they haven't been caught and caught out super publicly. So yeah. I think, yeah, that there could be ways that you can intervene there, but I'm not entirely sure. And obviously, I'm not really. Not really good when it comes to legal issues. And
yeah.
Those types of things and what's possible as well.
I mean, the next question up is Igor just saying, like, you know, should we try and regulate implicitly misleading ads? Like, you're not allowed to wear a lab coat if you're selling a magical spell. I don't think we're ever going to get to that place, are we? It's more about awareness and education, I think, to try and protect yourself from that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's two different questions, I reckon, whether it's realistic that we're going to achieve that, which I think we are not, because lobbying is just as strong and these companies have way too much power and way too much money behind them. And obviously, a lot of weight to throw around when it comes to battles like that. But ideally, it would be good if you at least have certain codes. Depends on how granular they're going to be, right? I'm not quite sure whether something like you can't advertise with a lab coat if you're not doing scientific nonsense, if you're doing unscientific nonsense, would work. But yeah, going in that direction, if I could wave a wand and it would be possible, I would obviously do it, because I would avoid an awful lot of misleading information, especially on the health front. And I guess that's the main issue that I have when it comes to people making health claims and trying to promise people healing, and then they end up wasting time on nonsensical bollocks while they could have actually gotten a functioning evidence-based cure in the meantime.
For sure, for sure. Okay, let's move on. The next question is from Neil. He would like you to expand on the racism in the font comment.
Yeah, that could kick off another lecture, but like, to make it really brief, the Waldorf font is associated to Steiner's Anthroposophie in German, and so Anthroposophie in English, which is like his school of thought that backs up everything. It backs up his ideas of design. It backs up his ideas of education, of agriculture, everything. And one of the core ideas that he's had is, for example, that there is like some spiritual growth that the human race as a whole has to go through. And he classified the development status with the Aryans being on top and other races being below that. So basically, as you proceed in the growth cycle as a kid, you start off on the level of a lower race, then you proceed to higher races, and then when you're finally done with your psychological growth, you kind of like graduate to become an Aryan. So the Aryan race thing is an issue there. And then he's also had like really weird associations. So there is like he compares indigenous people, like and Africans and Asians, with like primitive or childlike characteristics, which I think is quite clearly very racist and very problematic. And there are still things in the Waldorf school curricula also that kind of like hint in that direction. There are certain Waldorf schools that have distanced themselves from it, but it's still there granularly. So it's really problematic. And also, for those who don't know, it's like an alternative school system that's super crazy popular in Germany. There are a couple in the UK, but it's not nowhere near as prominent as it is with us.
Yeah. Okay. So be very careful, folks, if you're choosing a font for your tattoos. Okay.
Yes. Go with Comic Sans. Stay clear.
That's nice and safe, right?
Course, yeah.
Another question from Igor. Are there any good ways to shield yourself from the corporate Borg trying to psychologically trick us to consume as much, oh my God, Kackhornchen as possible?
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, I guess it all falls back to awareness and education, right? So, for example, with the Kackhörnchen thing very specifically, right? That's something that's like a downside of buying organic produce. There's another discussion to be had about how positive the impact of organic agriculture actually is, because there are things where it's better and there are things where it's worse in certain factors. So if you decide to buy organic, maybe have a look at the alternative organic labels and kind of like stick to that specific label, because you know they don't do the extra bullshit that you have to do, like literally, to get a Demeter label. So steer clear of Demeter. Be aware of the brands that you want to avoid. That is also, it works the other way around, right? So if you are aware of brands that you like, you can also be aware of brands that you try to steer clear of.
For sure. I mean, I suppose that, like, going back to sort of your earlier slides, like some of those, you know, those sort of pillars that are used to sort of define products and how they end up being marketed to us. If you're kind of aware of the game they are playing, then you can hopefully kind of rational your way around it. But sometimes things look lovely on the shelf, don't they? Talking of lovely things on the shelf, right? Those Manufactum chrome fire extinguishers, are they functional? Isn't there a law that they must be highly visible? Well,
I'm not sure about the law that they must be highly visible. I think that probably just applies to public spaces. So I'm pretty sure that you couldn't put that, like, I don't know, in a conference center or something. But they do function, and they are very much popular. So if you buy one for your home, you can have it there. I can see whether I can find it. I'm gonna post a link in the chat if I do.
It sounds awesome. I mean, I'd be expecting my chrome fire extinguisher to have sort of like, I don't know, champagne coming out of it or something like that, rather than actually being functional. But I'm sure they look really sexy. Let's see. Igor's back. A lot of brands are actually owned by like three mega corporations. I can't imagine that helps the situation. Is that correct?
That's a complex one, because yes, that's very much true, but it's quite ironic because they obviously try to kind of like have as broad a portfolio as they possibly can to speak to as many consumers as they possibly can. And I think a really good example for that is body care brands is Dove and Lynx, so Axe in Germany, I think in the US as well. Mm-hmm. If you look at the marketing and the way they kind of like sell their products and try to associate values with those, they couldn't be further apart, right? Because, you know, Dove sells to that, like, yeah, self-confidence, every body shape is great, you are legit, you feel comfy with us, very much tailored towards women as well, very inclusive campaigns. While at the same time, the very same umbrella brand says, hey guy, put on that vanilla scent Lynx and you have 16 very attractive, very slim women sticking to you within the span of 5 seconds. Which is very like sexist imagery, but it's all under the same umbrella. So the question is then where you do decide for yourself, where you cut off. Do you kind of like say, okay, I'm fine with subsidizing Dove, but not with buying Lynx, mm-hmm. which is also going to be, you know, filling the pockets of Unilever. But there's also an issue in terms of that. Yes, there are these five mega corporations. I think it's like Unilever, Johnson & Johnson, PG, Mars, Coca-Cola. So PepsiCo, I think there's other, but the Kraft, the main thing, like 10 or so. If you don't buy local and if you don't like become activist in your consumer choices and buy in supermarkets, it's really hard to escape that, because at the end of the day, most of what you actually do is going to end up in one of those companies' pockets. So you have to decide for yourself where your cutoff line is.
And I guess there's a somewhat line of differentiation between trying to buy ethically versus trying to buy products that actually work when we're talking about, you know, health claims and stuff as well. But
yeah.
I would imagine with all of that kind of financial and might behind them, then, you know, they're really interested in selling things and they've got the ability to sort of cross-fertilize those brands and stuff. The next question is from Anonymous, and let's be very clear, we're not giving out medical advice, but the question is, aren't all cough medicines bollocks anyway? I think you were showing like one, maybe legit, and one's definitely not. So I think I've heard in a few places that all of them are rubbish. Is that not the case?
take that with a huge grain of salt, like huge block of salt, because I'm not a pharmacist, but it depends on what kind of what the cough medicine's trying to do, because there are different types of medicines that do different types of things. There are those that are actually kind of like trying to get the slime out of your lungs so you can cough it off, and then there are just the in Germany you call them Hustenstiller, which is just like medicine that kind of like helps fight off the actual urge to cough the entire time. And some of them can, for example, actually work, because if you have like a really sore throat from a lot of coughing, it can actually soothe. It doesn't really cure the cough, but it helps ease the symptoms. So it depends on what they claim to do. As far as I know, so big block of salt in that one. But I have a pharmacist friend that I can ask and get back to you on with that.
It always helps to have a pharmacist on speed dial, right? Okay, on to a question from Serdar. Hello, Serdar. Okay, considering homeopathy was invented in Germany, do you think it has a different relationship with consumers? Also, are they slowly converging into naturopathy?
I think it definitely has a different standing in Germany than it has in the UK. I think if you look at the UK, the whole King Charles thing is not making things much better. And, you know, there are these what do they call the spider letters, right? The letters that he wrote to Parliament before he even became king, where he was trying to lobby for homeopathy being kind of like included in the NHS. So we have different health systems and different marketing system when it comes to that specifically. What I'm really pissed at, pissed with is the way that pharmacies in Germany function in some cases. So we don't have a lot of over-the-counter medicine like we do, like Boots, where we have that mixture, right, of pharmacy corner with the pharmacist, and the rest is just like cosmetics and over-the-counter stuff. We have very specific pharmacies that only sell medicine, over-the-counter stuff, and then also some free sold things, but it's only medicine. And then there's a very rare occasion that they sell some kind of like limited amount of cosmetics from pharmaceutical naturopathy brands. And this is I think more difficult to regulate than it is in the UK, because if you have normal consumer products that aren't really medicine related on the shelves right next to it, right, doesn't really matter if I can grab my, I don't know, my super nice pink non-gender branded Venus from Gillette shaver off the shelf right next to it, is not that much of a specific environment, while everything about a German pharmacy screams medicine, screams science. And if that crap is sold there, it has an entirely different level of credibility. So if I were to choose, I would ban that stuff from pharmacy shelves altogether. And I've had the experience, I'm not quite sure whether that's London specific, but there isn't as much homeopathy on the shelves in like Boots, for example, as there is in pharmacy shelves in Germany. Okay. So it's way more ingrained.
Good to know. All right, let's move on to an anonymous question. Do pets constitute a grooming ritual, since they require maintenance?
Pretty sure you can actually read it like that. But obviously, you do perform a lot of grooming rituals around the pets as well, right? Mm-hmm. You buy them treats, you buy them collars, you brush them, you groom them, and you buy the all the accessories that you need to do that. So there's tons of that where you can actually also express your love relationship to your furry little friends.
Absolutely. Okay, next question is from Grey the Earthling, and they were like to ask, since we can't have consumerism without people being harmed by pseudo-medicine, should the ultimate skeptic goal be to overthrow capitalism?
Speaking very much for myself and myself alone here, sure. No issue with overthrowing capitalism at all. But okay. Yeah. To be a bit more serious, that is obviously a political statement, right? I have huge issues with capitalist systems in many, many ways, and I think I'm not entirely sure that if we got rid of that we would get rid of WHO automatically. I think would just definitely reduce the urge to market it weirdly.
Okay, I mean, feel free to grab your pitchforks, everybody. Right, I'm sure there'll be a fair queue of skeptics behind you, but I wouldn't get your hopes up. Right,
make sure that the pitchforks haven't been used to dig in bullshit.
You know, I guess the best we can hope for and the best we can advocate for is some more controls on capitalism and some honesty and some caps. But that's somewhat
difficult one.
before I get too depressed, let's move on. We've got another question from Serdar. There you go, Serdar. You're like buses, man. Just two come along at the one time. Does American consumerism impact woo consumption differently than in Europe?
I'd say yes, because this whole consumer marketing thing is ironically at the same time global, but also context specific. There are obviously brands that you always that you can only buy in certain areas, and if you look at international brands, they will maintain certain local brands within their portfolio if they buy another company, and they will rebrand stuff for certain regions. I don't know, like for example, Wall's, the ice cream brand, 16 different names across Europe, such as Set Links and X. They're also branded differently in different countries. So you can see with ordinary consumer products that this is the case, and I think it's very much the same for Woo. So the whole homeopathy thing and anthroposophy thing is way more prominent in Germany, for example, than it is in the UK. And I haven't come across it as prominently in the US as well, because they don't have at least as far as I know, which I'm not super literate on the US market. They have a ton of organic stuff that's kind of like emerging, but nowhere near as tied in with the anthroposophic market as it is the case in Europe. So I assume that's similar for other things.
You know, one thing that gets me anytime I've been in the States is seeing medical adverts on the television. It's super weird seeing that from someone in the UK. I'm glad we haven't quite imported that in any serious way.
Yeah, yet. I mean, especially when you talk about when you start talking about medicine, there's tons of other regulation issues, right? So there's the legal systems are also obviously quite different. So the things that you are allowed to sell and put in things are way more problematic in many, many ways, especially when it comes to like supplements, for example. US is hardly ever regulated. So there's actually people that have died of lead poisoning from some kind of supplement where the facilities weren't clean enough or they've been produced because the FDA doesn't oversee that. So there's issues on that end already. And then there's very similar issues when it comes to what you can and cannot advertise.
Absolutely. Right, let's move on to the brilliantly named Karen Tankeris, who is asking, if you were to construct a short course exposing and explaining this stuff to ordinary non-academics or non-skeptics, let's say, what would be at the top of your reading list?
Well, if there were an English version available, it would definitely be Haben von Wolfgang by Wolfgang Ulrich, because that's a book that delves into an awful lot of background, basic knowledge. But there is actually really good English language literature on the way marketing functions. That's not super specific to skepticism and to that type of stuff, but that's really helpful in understanding how the processes work. So there's Martin Neumeier's book that I've referenced a couple of times. And then there's also a researcher called Daniel Miller. I think he says LSE, or was at LSE, who does an awful lot of research on the way consumerism impacts and is shaped by relationships, interpersonal relationships. And that's quite helpful, I think.
Awesome. Get it on your reading list, folks. Next question from Gray the Earthling, Return to Earth. Here we go. Is there a link between brand loyalty and addiction, especially for brands who design their products to be addictive, like social media corporations?
I'd assume yes, but I don't have any proper like sources to back that up. So be careful with that. And I'm not quite sure how much of a difference it makes whether you're actually talking about stuff that you actively engage with, like, for example, game consoles, apps, social media type things, or whether you're actually talking about like everyday brands. Brand loyalty is obviously a huge issue, but that's also something that's very comparable to like parasocial relationships that you build up. You have a good experience with the brand. And if you're not an adventurous person who wants to try to have every energy drink in the world, if you've had a Red Bull and you liked it, you're going to stick to Red Bull very likely, unless there's anything that persuades you to kind of like get off that brand where something goes wrong with the brand. Similar thing, for example, with divestment companies that have been targets of divestment and boycotts. Nestle, for example. Tons of people have tons of Nestle products in their houses. And when they did that really horrific thing with trying to restrict access to drinking water for white populations in parts of Africa, there's an ethical question there. So then you had kind of like to look out for other brands. I think it's an individual character type question more than anything.
Yeah, I think we saw a lot of upset in the US when was it Bud Light? One of the
beers. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, was sort of, shall we say, advertiser endorsed by somebody that their usual demographic wouldn't be interested in. And
that's a very nice way of putting that.
you get Kid Rock like shooting cans and stuff. You know, it's very, you know, poor brand loyalty from Kid Rock. But then, what do you expect, right? But yeah. I guess everybody's got their limits as to when they say no to a brand. But I like, in terms of addiction, I don't necessarily know, because, you know, let's say if you have an alcohol problem and you don't want to drink Bud Light, you've got plenty of other, you know, choices as well. So maybe it doesn't come into play too much.
Yeah, I think it kind of like depends on what the product or what the brand kind of like triggers in you, I guess. So if you have like really strong positive reactions to one specific brand or one specific product and you kind of like keep returning to that very specific one, I think it's a very different thing from like actual physical addiction, right? Like a drinking problem is, or like, I don't know, smoking, for example, is why you can't get off the nicotine and you can't kick it to the curb without actually having to kind of like go through some kind of, I don't know, lengthy process where you can't just ditch it from one day to the other. But like psychological factors, I think I could imagine that there'd be some similarities, but I'm not entirely sure how realistic that actually is.
Okay. In which case, let's move on to yet another question from Igor. So as far as I see, this "we are what we eat" phenomenon is only used for evil capitalist purposes, but can it be used for good?
I think it can. For sure it can. So another book that I mentioned earlier, if anybody wants to grab something that goes more into like the capitalist criticism and like more political side of things, it's Naomi Klein's No Logo, which is very much focused on how branding impacts the way we consume things and the way like certain corporations have the power that they have and the impact that they have. And the way you could do that is, for example, just do really, really basic things that many people can do. Not everybody, but many can. It's like, try to buy local produce, for example, if you at all have a chance. Try to make sure that your carbon footprint isn't that big. Like all these types of things that have, like, obviously in the grander scheme of things, a minor impact, but they can obviously also communicate something and help you divest. I don't know, ditch your Tesla and set it on fire.
Yeah, we at Skeptics the Pub Online don't advocate for any
your own very personal Tesla, as long as nobody in the vicinity, right? So it's not like anybody else's Tesla, your own.
Make sure you get consent from the Tesla owner before you set it on fire, folks, okay? Okay, let's move on before I say something libelous. Andrew Kay is back. Is there any country that seems to have got the balance right in terms of ensuring consumers are protected?
That's a broad question. I'd instinctively say no. I'd be very surprised that if there were any within like the grander scheme of capitalist consumer culture. So I don't expect so, no. And then it's also the question is like, what do you think of, like, what do you define as what's protected is?
Yeah, I guess that's a hard one to call. That could be a whole research topic in itself, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there are, for example, I think it was Chile, not quite sure, but like some Southern American country that, for example, has banned marketing to kids. So they've basically forced corporations to remove, for example, the smiley face from the Pringles can. They've removed Tony from the Frosties, the Gold Bear from the Haribo Gold Bears. So it's nothing there that directly appeals to children. So no childish cartoon characters that draws their attention to the products. So stuff like that, which might seem... has gotten surprisingly much backlash, but that's actually something that I think is possible to do, where you can protect people better, especially young ones.
Well, I mean, as the proud father of a 6-year-old, I think I would applaud any type of restriction in that sense, because I mean, I certainly get bombarded with requests from my lovely daughter to buy things that she's spotted in the shops, you know. To the detriment of my wallet and the walking space in my house.
Yeah, direct marketing to children is an issue. It really is.
For sure, yeah. Okay, back to Grey the Earthling. Do other languages have fun and interesting different phrases for snake oil. Maybe you can tell us what it is, what the equivalent is in German.
Well, we tend to say Schwurbel more broadly, but that's not necessarily just snake oil. But there's also, we've got kind of a super boring literal translation, which is Schlangenöl.
Oh.
And I'm afraid I only speak German and English in any bearable capacity, so I don't have much other languages to draw from. But there's definitely somebody in the chat who has. I don't know.
Yeah.
Igor, I mean, where are
come
you?
Come on, people in the chat. Come on, our multilingual friends in the chat. Or at least there are people who are good at Googling. Get stuff into the chat there and let us know. Okay. The last question. No surprise it's an anonymous one, because we're gonna end on a controversial topic, which has split the nation down the middle. So Rebecca, be very careful about how you answer this one. What are your thoughts on the Aldi versus M&S, Colin versus Cuthbert caterpillar cake feud?
Oh yeah, that was one for the that was the legal feud of the millennium, I think. I looked it up earlier. I think they settled out of court. I'm not sure what the agreement was, but if I had been the judge, I would definitely say it's been clear trademark infringement. Mm-hmm. And it's a UK classic, I think. So everybody in the UK knows Colin the Caterpillar. So I don't know what's next. Maybe little does Percy the Pig.
As I can testify, I have eaten both, and the taste is similar. They're both delightfully shaped as well. So yeah, I'm not surprised. I suppose that is the great kind of consumer lawsuit of our time. Although it does remind me of the great Jaffa cakes biscuit or cake debate/court cases as well, which presumably I think, folks, we can fight about in our Zoom pub, the Lock-ins Razor, later on this evening. Okay, Rebecca, we have exhausted our questions. Probably we've exhausted you as well. I should say, there was some lovely compliments about the beautiful background, right, that you've got going on there. Lovely consumer products, and you've really kind of stated your own personal brand with style with that. So thank you for living the dream in that respect. So folks, please, in the text chat again, lots of text-based applaud and emojis and other such niceties for our speaker this evening. Before we go, though, folks, just a reminder for you. Our next event is Cass Peters on the 22nd of May. The Cane Only Works If You Use It is an extended version of the Skepticamp talk. So we will see you next month. We'll see you in the virtual pub, which will be opening shortly. Before we go, would like to thank Igor and Matty on tech, and Gerald for being the wind beneath my wings and assisting me all the way through this evening as well. What a team. So again, folks, in the chat, give your applause to the fantastic SIPPO team who've helped bring you this delightful talk this evening. That's us, though. Otherwise,
and thanks for moderating, Brian.
Ah, what a pleasure it was. Cheers, everybody. See you next time. Eggman out.
Yeah, bye bye.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thola Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.